Hey folks, welcome to another edition of the Ownership Economy Podcast. This is going to be another one of our episodes that's a little low-key and more of a conversation. This week we bring you an episode with Jihad Ismail, who is heading up Creator and Community Capital at the Forefront. Jihad has written a lot of great thought leadership on tokenized communities. We get into the differences between DAOs and tokenized communities. What are they? How do they differ? How are they the same? We also look at some of the ins and outs of organizational structure and getting things done in DAOs. Jihad then goes real deep on Nouns DAO and how it works and why it's so fascinating. And you basically emerge from it with a set of patterns that may tell you essentially how to design your DAO to live in perpetuity. And then we get into some of the things around Tragedy of the Commons, the free rider problem, and all kinds of other things that could come up in the life of Nouns DAO. We hope you enjoy the episode, and as always, remember to subscribe and please leave us feedback, whether you're listening to Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, or any other platform. Thank you very much. Jihad, the man, it's been too long. Thanks for joining the pod today.
It's been a minute. How are you, sir?
Very well. Honestly, I've been missing our conversations about community, venture, open source software, all kinds of stuff. So very eager to get into that today with you. But first, before we get any further, why don't you tell the audience the story of Jihad? Who are you? How did you get here today? Tell it however you like. Start wherever you want.
Always a good time, sir. I remember the first time we got on the phone, or the first time you DM'd me, it was like, I like look at the name and I'm just like that Spider-Man meme where it's like you're pointing at each other.
Like, oh, that's been my whole life, by the way. I think we did talk about this where it was like, hey, excuse me, especially post 9/11. Sorry, not sorry. When you have the, oh, is your name Jihad? And I'm like, God, motherfucker. But anyway, sorry for cussing so early into the podcast.
But
exactly.
No, so I'm Jihad. I currently am I'm on the core team at Forefront doing all things, I would say, non-technical. Forefront is an organization supporting tokenized communities through product, media, and community. Prior to that, I was working at Syndicate Protocol, also in like a GTM role. And prior to that, I helped co-found a creator agency where we helped big YouTubers grow their audiences, make more money. That was sort of my segue into Web3 that ended up getting acquired earlier this year. My co-founder was still working on it. And sort of my interest in Web3 comes from this intersection of like internet native organizations, like creator lifestyle, monetization, and just like post-capitalist economics, which is how I found myself in the DAO space.
That's awesome. And honestly, it makes a lot of sense. Not that I try to pick on too many people in our ecosystem, but it seems like you can, with that background, you may be able to give a full-throated, authentic sort of approach to the whole ownership economy thing. Maybe. We'll see. But anyway, so first, I do want to unjargonify some of the stuff you said. Not that you're a big jargon guy. It's just that this is what happens when we talk, when people get together. Quickly, the room fills with jargon. So the first one I kind of would like to have you break down for us is what is a tokenized community?
I still think that definition is like very much TBD. We've written a couple of essays on it at Forefront, and we didn't really coin the term either, but we sort of took that term and tried to add our own flavor to it, strictly because people, I guess rewinding a bit, Forefront started off as a social token aggregator. So we were talking about all things in the social token ecosystem, and we were also aggregating like market data about like the 10 social tokens that existed, right? Social tokens were also, despite the fact that there were only a few of them, like an umbrella term for creator tokens, which were supposedly allow you to like invest in individual creators, for community tokens, which were supposed to be like governance and reputation tokens within internet communities, and a few other like subcategories that have come to exist since then. I think slowly we realized, at least personally, that like creator tokens were slightly less exciting, at least as they existed at that point, and they just didn't work the way that people thought they were going to work. And it was
these were the ones that basically be like, hey, I'm a creator, I want to sell 1 million tokens and you can moon with me,
and yeah, you
people join in,
you can control my life by governing.
Oh boy. Yeah. Right. I remember that. There was one dude specifically, I remember, I forget his name. It was like an Eastern European dude, but yes.
Alex was the first one. Like, it was a cool idea. It was a really, really dope idea. I just don't think that it like played out the way everybody expected it to. But so we sort of like moved into this like social DAO space because we realized that we were focused on like this new type of organization that was getting popular, but we weren't focused on like the DeFi and protocol DAOs because those felt slightly different than what we were working on. Like, social DAO was also a really bad term because, like, aren't all DAOs social? Like, isn't the entire point? Aren't all organizations inherently social? Like, what does the social descriptor actually mean? So we start, like, playing a little bit more with the types of organizations that we were working with and how we were defining it. And it became, like, a real, like, existential problem for us because we sort of, like, intuitively knew, like, the types of organizations that we wanted to work with and build. But our like the intuitions of our core team were not communicated well throughout the entire ecosystem. So I started working on like, okay, what is this thing here? Who are the types of people, founders, organizations, et cetera, that we're trying to attract? And we landed on this idea that tokenized communities are really meme-driven capital allocation machines. And that's also a bunch of jargon. So like,
No. I really love that, actually. I do that. I mean, I agree it is jargon, but like, it's such a good encapsulation of the moment because, like, I mean, meme-driven capital allocation machine, just look around, right? Like, we're I feel like GameSpot was like 10 years ago, but it was literally like, you know, 18, 20, 24 months ago. And that's like, you know, what did we just experience in the last 13, 14 years of bull market? It was memes, bro, right? Like 100%. So, yeah.
It was memes. And it was obviously like memes broadly defined, right? But at the end of the day, it was memes. And I think we realized that when you look at organizations like Gitcoin with Public Goods, with Kraushaus and buy an NBA team, with Cabin, Decentralized City, like at the end of the day, these organizations are meme-driven organizations. And like that is what is bringing people to the fold. And those memes could be like very meaningful, like buying an NBA team or building a decentralized city or funding public goods. And they could also be very broad and abstract, like nouns, right? And it's quite literally just the proliferation of the glasses everywhere everywhere that your heart desires.
Yeah.
So we started building on that thesis a bit more. Like I said, wrote a couple of essays on it and figured that like that focus on capital allocation and specifically like community-driven capital allocation for the sake of propagating the meme or like building towards that collective mission was like slightly different than a protocol DAO, which could be doing some capital allocation, but primarily exists to govern the protocol, right? So Forefront wanted to be at the frontier of not only building tools for that specific type of organization, which we're doing now, but also like narrowing the scope of our media and narrowing the scope of the conversations and the community that we're attracting to focus on those specific types of organizations and all the different use cases from going back to my background with like YouTube and like traditional creators coming into the space and finding alternative funding mechanisms all the way to these more like big globally mission-driven organizations like Cabin. So yeah, it's sort of like a square rectangle thing. Like I don't necessarily think all DAOs are tokenized communities, but I would actually, you could make the argument that all tokenized communities probably aren't DAOs either, but like there's enough overlap there that we use the terms interchangeably, but we focus on tokenized communities as like the type of org that we're going after.
I think that makes sense. Maybe it might not make as much sense to our listeners, but some context I would like to bring to it is the fact that, you know, there's Mark Balin from Myco, right, was on earlier in, I think it was episode 13 or so, I'll have to dig it up. But basically, Mark Balin, what they're doing, I would basically call a tokenized community, right? And they wanted to make this their whole thing, and why we were really fascinated with it is that they wanted to build a way to share wealth and distribute the wealth that comes from a creator community. And they wanted to make a legal instrument that rides along with it and a set of, you know, software that makes it easy to deploy that so that, you know, you can actually just do that, right? And the first thing they did was PixelPunks with that front. And the whole thing was basically, hey, we're going to make it easy for people to put LLCs to spin up an LLC by clicking a button. And then if they get other people to join, we can give them a diluted mechanism such that there's an incentive for the people who join at, you know, the fifth person to join still has an incentive as the fifth and the 50th person does and the 500th person does, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great example of a tokenized community because if you're on the internet and you're using free and open source software, there's no way for you to really distribute and capture the value that you're creating from a community like this, a creator community like this, except if you enter, you know, you try to solve that by saying, hey, well, actually, here's a mechanism, whether it's a DAO or it's an LLC that's spun up with a click of a button like in MICO. But it's all kind of the same idea. And I think that goes back to your thing about how all tokenized communities are not DAOs, but all DAOs might be tokenized communities, right?
Right, exactly. And I also think, like, when you start to really think about these ideas around like governance and just like abstract it out a bit from like what we traditionally think of as governance, or like capital allocation and abstract it out a bit from what we traditionally think of as capital allocation, like these ideas become much clearer. There are just like certain spaces that these terms that we're using are just traditionally associated with. And I feel like it sort of just skews the lens with which we're viewing them.
Sweet. And so at Forefront, you folks are now kind of focused on building tools to support tokenized communities. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say like tools and media blueprints, those sorts of things. Like I think like we're trying to aggregate and curate all of the best practices in the space, all of the great experiments that are happening, and bring those to the table for folks as well.
Awesome. So tell us a bit more about that. What does that look like in the day-to-day? Because I'll tell you, you know, a little bit of a sidebar, I guess. I guess it's going to be, God, time goes so fast. It's September 2022, but I think about probably around March 2021, I had jumped into the Forefront Discord and DAO in the Growth Guild, right? And I didn't really do much, but I didn't really know what I was growing. So I'd love to, you know, if you could actually tell people, hey, this is what Forefront is trying to grow. I know you guys have a newsletter. You have a lovely tool that gives people an idea in one view of, hey, this is the health of a DAO or of a community. These are who's come in. These are who the holders are. These are the payment, all that kind of stuff. So tell us a bit more about what's going on at Forefront.
Oh, man. So to your point about not knowing what you were growing back in early last year, I don't think anybody knew what they were growing early last year. I think the evolution of Forefront has been one of just like crazy experimentation that got really, really messy. And at some point, the people who had stuck around were like, okay, we got to continue this culture of experimentation, but rein it in a bit to figure out like what exactly we're going to focus on and what we're going to like point some energy towards. To get a little bit more concrete, like we said, we're focused specifically on this type of organization that is tokenized communities. Those organizations are focused on capital allocation towards a collective meme, but specifically, we think that the core primitive of a tokenized community is the project. It is a small group of people coming together and bringing something new to life that is propagating that meme or building towards that mission in some capacity. I want to go back to nouns because like for all its flaws, I think it is like the community that is doing this best right now, right? Like whether it's through Prop House or whether it's through traditional nouns governance, people are putting up crazy proposals, everything from we are going to throw like a nouns parade or something in random countries throughout the world, all the way to we are going to build like critical infrastructure for nouns and nouns forks in order for more communities like this to exist, right? And obviously Nouns has lots of money in their treasury, which means that they are able to allocate effectively to all of these orgs. But there's just like awesome creativity and experimentation. And I think like we're seeing this a little bit more across other communities as well, whether it's like FWB will throw some hackathons and will fund those projects that come out of those hackathons at various intersections of like Web3 and culture, right?
With that Andreessen Horowitz money too, God bless them.
With the A16Z money.
Love it. Keep doing it at FWB forever.
Oh yeah. I mean, Zora does a little bit of that as well, although Zora isn't currently a DAO. I mean, you see this across the space, right? And I think Nouns just like has made it their entire MO. Like Nouns just does it consistently. They have a lot of different ways that they do it, and that's all they do. I think what two trends we're going to begin to see around like this project primitive is we expect these projects to be autonomous and persistent in and of themselves and to like exist cross network. One great example of this is you mentioned the tool that Forefront is building to like get a health check on your DAO, basically. We call that Terminal. We don't want Terminal to be a Forefront project in the long term. We want this to be a project that maybe was like incubated by the Forefront core team, but exists autonomously and is funded across different networks that feel that it is valuable for their communities, right? So the tokenized community itself is the funding mechanism, it's the governance mechanism, but the project come out of them maybe live within these umbrellas of like the broader community, but are independent of them.
No, I actually really love that idea because this is this goes back to an idea that I think is really critical to dig into on a podcast called The Ownership Economy, because traditionally when you look at and you consider ownership, it's within the firm, right? And the firm has fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders, and that's about it, right? Like, in, of course, there are regulations that they have to follow, and, you know, crimes and AML and, you know, terrorism, et cetera. But it's fiduciary responsibilities to its shareholders. And what I find really fascinating about tokenized communities is, and the future of ownership, which is all about what we like to talk about here, is that you are really extending and making really amorphous the border between organizations, where they end and where others begin, right? And so this is a great example where you put a product out there. And if we think about a Web 2 context here, actually, I don't really like the Web 2, Web 3, you know, divide personally between me and you. Like, I think it's kind of almost meaningless. What I'd actually say instead is a company, a traditional LLC or joint stock company that owns IP rights to a specific piece of software that it puts out has very specific licenses and structures that enable other people to contribute to it. If you don't do that, you don't follow the rules, your access is cut off, right? And sure, it makes sense because they have a business bottom line at the end, but what it actually doesn't enable is this sort of endless creativity that takes it to new places and creates new economic value for, you know, more than just the line manager that owns that API, right? Coming back to the point here, when you have a product like Forefront Terminal, I think this is a really great example where you can also say Gitcoin or, you know, some other group, maybe, you know, like, God, why is it? I can't think of any others than, I was just thinking of Chainalysis, and you would never have Chainalysis work on this between me and you, of course, but just any group out there that's good at shipping Web3 APIs, right? Someone who goes, hey, we want to develop this further. And you guys are in a spot where you're like, we've already put the thing out there. We can together decide what the economic value of it is, whether we actually get a fee from it or if it's a free and open source good forever, right? But the conversation can be had on more terms than just, here is the license agreement, sir. And so that's one of the really fascinating things, that you're able to extend where one firm ends and where another begins, and it becomes kind of just this melding, right?
Exactly. And I think there's this question, there's like news in the US recently about like Biden, I think it was an executive order, that all publicly funded research now needs to be free by 2024, I don't know, something like that. Oh, but
amazing.
So yeah, that's great. That should have happened a long time ago. But I think the principle behind that is, like, you have a lot of different people funding it. It's coming from taxpayer dollars, and therefore a lot of different people, if not everybody, should be able to access that thing, right? I think the same goes for like these products and projects that are coming out of decentralized organizations. If you have if a network of organizations are funding this thing, it should not just be limited to that network of organizations, because the next project might be funded by a different network, right? And trying your best to keep these things as open as possible while still obviously retaining value for the communities that are funding them is really, really important. And I think what is most interesting is when we go back to this idea of ownership and governance, the value is not necessarily dollars flowing back to the treasury, but the value is governance power over the way that that thing is going to function, the freedom that project is going to have, the power to say, like, everybody is going to access this versus nobody is going to access this. That is value in of itself, right?
Absolutely, because it's funny you say that, because I mean, we're just going to play off of that. I've tried many ways to explain this to people, because people are frequently surprised by my position on intellectual property, which is that I think almost all of it should be abolished, and that it creates situations of artificial scarcity, and, you know, these situations broadly apply across bluntly in every domain, right? Like, okay, fine, I can see if you want to have, mind you, this is not my position, but I can understand if you're like, oh, I want to have IP rights to mean something or creative, whatever. But then when we start getting into things like DNA, healthcare, all these other things that suddenly become patentable and excludable goods, you're like, ah, no thanks, right? Like, that's part of the reason why we're in a lot of the messes that we are because of the bluntness of the IP tool, right? And so, you know, what I actually try to tell people is that, like, you, when you think, well, what are we going to do? How are people going to innovate? They've got to be able to be like, this is mine and I can charge rent for it and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, that's, well, it's funny how people jump in and take the perspective they take is of a person who might one day create something that they can be a landlord for, right? Like, that's the perspective they take immediately. They're like, well, what if I want to be the landlord, right? And it's like, no. Nobody should. But second, you can have a situation, you can create, you know, buckets that people can play in with regulation even that says, well, actually, we're not going to respect the, you know, so you're doing it right now, literally, like with Forefront, right? With nouns, everyone's doing it right now. They're like, we've created this bucket of constraints that people can create in. The value is freely shared. And look at that value keeps being created, right? And so my point with this is that when you zoom, you're only taking the perspective of being a potential landlord and being mad that someone stole your shit. When if you zoom out, the situations we should be trying to create are these situations where competition still exists. And the competition that comes out of that, obviously the products that come out of that, the services that come out of that, their value flows can still be bent inward a bit for the people who also make it such that people can freely innovate and still build on top of each other. And with the, and obviously when you look out there, it's like, that's literally what happens when you don't restrain these things until someone comes along and goes, I don't really like that you're doing that, and I'm going to sue you, right? And so like the whole point with with my rambling thing here on IP is that all we should really be looking at is the ontological level where these things are happening, and not only think of ourselves in an adversarial way where the two objects are you as the potential landlord and another landlord in competition with you. Actually, right. The competition benefits everyone in around you. And when you constrain the ability to build on top of it, you are constraining so many possibilities, so many unexplored things that we could all be doing together instead of adversarially, right?
It's, man, there's so many different directions this conversation can go. One of the things
take us somewhere.
A friend and I were chatting the other day about we're having all of these debates about what makes DAOs valuable, or just what makes free and open source organizations, free and open source software, whatever it may be, what makes them valuable, right? And then they asked the question, what makes a company valuable? If we really just boil it down, why is a C Corp in the United States, just as to put constraints on the example, valuable, right? And we started doing some research. We're there are different valuation mechanisms that people use for valuing a public company. Most of them are based on cash flows. But at the end of the day, as a stockholder, I am basically holding on to rights of future cash flow. Right.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I might never, ever, ever, ever use, it's almost a guarantee. I will never, ever, ever get that cash flow. Right. I'm only going to get the stock.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're basically holding on to these these made up items that folks haven't invented that are your IOU to cash flows in the events that you the company sells, or in the event that the company decides to distribute that thing in the form of dividends, right? But most stocks don't even have dividends. So
they're like buybacks, man, or right. Bonuses, right? Their governance is also hijacked, which is a huge other conversation. But yes, sorry, continue.
It's a whole other conversation. So then you zoom out a little bit, I think it's more a question of something about the organization is valuable, right? Right now, the traditional frame of reference is it's the fact that this organization has cash flows and I individually have rights to my share of the cash flows, right? When in reality, what DAOs basically are, or tokenized communities, or whatever term you want to use, is I have right to govern collective cash flows, right? Like everybody is holding on to this money and I have right to govern the way that that money is going to be distributed. I am not necessarily receiving a dividend based off of my share in this organization. I just have governance power over the shared assets or the shared set of assets. That's a really simple idea, but it's when you frame it in that way and with that contrast, really interesting, it's such a huge unlock for me.
Oh, absolutely.
And more specifically, because then you start to draw that parallel of governance over shared assets or shared resources to other things, right? Like nouns, you're not just governing the shared treasury, but nouns in and of itself is a culture that has been created, right? It's this proliferation of the meme. And by participating in the ecosystem, you are governing the culture, right? Every participant in the ecosystem is governing the meme and is governing the culture. And we're just creating protocols, we're creating formalities about the way that that governance occurs and the way that those interactions happen. And once you start to think about it like that, for me, I start to see it everywhere now. Every act that we do within various organizations or within various cultures is an act of governance. And that,
funnily enough, I think in this episode, which I didn't see coming, I thought that we have gotten closer, I think, to the heart of what this ownership economy idea is in terms of the way we describe it, with, you know, broadly distributing governance rights so that we may more broadly distribute wealth that results from ventures in new forms of economic organization, right? Like, that's basically the way, that's the mouthful we use to describe it if you go to our Apple podcasts or, you know, Anchor, what have you, right? And so I think this is a really interesting way to put it, because it's right there, as you said, who has the rights to fund a new venture, to fund something, to point funding from a corporate treasury at a new thing? Well, it's the same old thing as it's been for about 600 years, right? It's the, okay, I'm being purposely kind of obtuse, sure, whatever. But like, but my point being that, like, it's a strict hierarchy that started out between, you know, you're reading about this now, as we said before the pod, talking about Medici, right? But it started out as the hierarchy of church, state, and various executors of that state who had said, hey, we think we should do a venture to Hispaniola, we'll call it, right? And because we think this, that, and the other. Whereas now, you know, you have executives with fiduciary responsibility, boards with, you know, fiduciary responsibility, shareholders who didn't say, after much analysis and cope, we've decided that we're going to go this way and not that way, right? And I think that, and it's not just me, a lot of my point of view on this comes from complexity science for the most part, where essentially the idea is that you, in cybernetics, but you don't need all the fancy math or anything to describe it. The simplest way to say it is essentially that, hey, there's inherent instability in disordered systems, sure. But at the same time, when you inject order via hierarchy, you vastly limit the phase space that can be explored by the, you know, agents who are there in that space, right? And by vastly increasing the space of decisions that they, the agency for the agents, the ways they can act, the decisions they can make, you open up a whole bunch of possibilities, right? And I think that's, going back to your original point, that's really what this is all about. How are corporations and DAOs different? Well, corporations, of course, you have the hierarchies, you have all that, and that's fine. They work really well for that, right? The alternatives are just saying, let's see what happens when you open up that space to new governance structures and to many, many, many more people exploring the phase spaces there. And then seeing how we can bend that back and allocate the capital and the decisions in these new directions as fast as possible.
That's such a great explanation. I also like, there's this thread that I continue to like add to this conversation as well around liberal neutrality. Like this idea that the types of organizations that we see today came to fruition because the value that was being upheld was that like everybody's individual preferences should be like put down, and we should just like try to hit like lowest common denominator at the organizational level. I think what we're seeing in DAOs today is that like, as a result of I as an individual now having governing power over this shared set of assets or whatever it might be, these organizations are becoming like much more normative, right? It's much more about what the organization should do outside of just like returns to shareholders. And to your point, like that was the limitation, right? Like the organization's purpose were always like, we had to return to shareholders, and there was no other room for any separate purpose. And over the past like 20 years, I would say we've seen more conversations around like triple bottom line, like organization, like corporations should be more, should have other incentives outside of just generating profits, but has always been like, oh, whoa, you can't say something is more important than profit. You could just say that like they're number two and number three closely behind.
And I think that's a very good point, actually, because this is, you know, more complexity, more entropy. There's a lot of ways to go with this. And we know, I used to be a scientist and I'm really into theories of origin of life, but the really one that's very fruitful these days is the stuff around hydrothermal vents and the fact that new phase spaces and states of chemical complexity were accessed by, you know, the flow of, I'm going to skip all the fucking chemistry, but essentially just, you know, olivine rocks, H2S, hydrogen sulfide. And, you know, all you needed was a electric potential difference for you to have your first cell sort of emerge. And this is becoming one of the more predominant theories of life. But the idea is actually neg entropy, right? The idea being that, like, actually, the maximizing energy flow and increasing entropy and complexity is what leads to higher forms of life. One of it's and it's the biophysical theory of life, and it's like not some kooky bullshit. There's plenty of mainstream scientists who are kind of advocating for it, but I found that to be a very interesting idea in the context of what you're talking about here, because you just even look at the triple bottom line thing, right? You have one thing in this room, everybody. I have a vision and a mission and blah blah blah, but at the end of the day, if anything gets in the way of profits in return to shareholders, then go fuck yourself, essentially, right? And that ends up being, that's the tension you're kind of pointing out here, because everything has to be categorical, right? It can't, it's, number one is this, number two is that, number three is this, right? There isn't room for more complexity and evolution in preferences and values, right? Those, there's always going to be a pecking order, and there isn't a way to explore orthogonal dimensions of that, right? And so that, I think, is a really fascinating idea of what you said. And because that, again, is that when someone says, why should we do DAOs? I'm like, man, I think almost all of them are failures, and they may forever be failures, but they're enabling us to explore these new ways of juggling our values and preferences in ways that we cannot possibly do them in these other circumstances.
And that is the key point, right? Like, there are, in my mind, at least, there are clear technical reasons why crypto and the space that we're playing in right now, like, is bringing more opportunity to the table as far as like expanding the ownership economy, right? You can make the argument though that there are absolutely no technical reasons, that like crypto is all BS, that it's all a scam. Like, yeah, you could go ahead and make that argument. You still cannot deny the fact that something about the ecosystem, something about DAOs and all the technology that surrounds it is encouraging more and more people to experiment with these questions. And again, like you said, all of these organizations theoretically could fail, 90% of them could fail, whatever it might be. But that experimentation is still very, very exciting. And for the first time in a very long time, we are seeing like mainstream experimentation with new forms of ownership, with new forms of capital allocation, with what these questions of like what actually does make an organization valuable or a thing valuable. I think just getting people thinking about that is a use case for crypto in and of itself, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a very good point, because like we're just going to do this, by the way, the rest of the podcast, next 20 minutes, it's going to be a back and forth, just, you know, volleys one after another. We're just like, yep, I think that's a good point. I think that's a good point. We're just going to keep doing this. But the, what I think is the good point, right, is like, there are some, you know, folks out there in the Twitters and elsewhere, editorial pages of certain online publications, which I won't name, who are always putting the FUD out there and saying, like, you know, and some of them are also highly, you know, technically skilled, brilliant engineers of distributed systems and all that kind of stuff, who are like, well, this technology is garbage. Why don't you just use a database? Well, you could just use fucking Oracle user relational database. This doesn't make any sense. And it goes back to what you're saying, is that these technologies enable new forms of social organization, right? If you wanted to make a transaction that nobody knew about except for the person that you wanted it to be available to, hey, congratulations, 1980s zero knowledge proofs, a math concept that no one ever thought had a use case, now has one, right? And so, like, you know, things like that, where it's like, well, do I want to denominate the local economic activity in my neighborhood in a fiat currency that's backed by blood and oil in the far off world land that I don't actually inhabit on my island here? Or do I want to actually bootstrap a local economy with liquidity based on something that mostly is going to stay here? And if there's a currency shock, it won't fuck me, right? So that's like, that. Now these are real questions you could ask and not be nuts, right? Now, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The not be nuts part is most interesting, right? I do sometimes wonder, like, if we were to have like a universal scale, how much of the innovation and excitement that's happening in the space is just like social? It's people just realizing it's okay to be nuts and ask these questions, and how much of the innovation is technical? I would argue that the majority of it is social, right? The majority of it is just people thinking, saying like, okay, like it's cool to ask these questions. There are other people on Twitter that I think are cool that are asking these questions. So sure, I'm going to ask it too. And yeah, like that's the exciting part for me. I want to make this conversation a little bit less kumbaya.
Oh, so yeah, let's do it. Let's go dark. Let's do it.
I will push to you this idea of like, so one of the things that we're seeing in the space right now is like missionaries versus mercenaries in these organizations. Again, we'll just continue to use nouns because I think it's just a good example, especially for this.
Oh, by the way, one sec before you go dark on me, I should have asked you to explain this 25 minutes ago. For people who have no idea what Nouns DAO is, tell us real quick what it is.
Yes. Nouns DAO is a DAO. Do we have to explain DAO? I think we're good on that one.
We're good on that one. Yeah.
Nouns DAO is a DAO that is minting one NFT a day forever, right? That NFT acts as specifically governance power over the Nouns treasury. And all of the revenue from that NFT goes into the Nouns community treasury to be governed by all the Nouns holders. The only stated mission of the Nouns community is to proliferate the Nouns meme. And there's all this conversation around like what it means to be Nounish and is there more to the meme than meets the eye? But in reality, the Nouns meme is just like this pair of glasses that exist on like these various things. There are nouns, right? It's not just like animals, but it's also like skateboards and like, you know, like you can get a noun of anything. But so Nouns has been touted as like the purest form of a tokenized community because the mission is quite literally meaningless. It is just to proliferate this meme.
This is like the most postmodern like thing ever, where all sources of meaning from modernism have been fractured, and you can create. I will put a real link to, you know, the 1976 thing that originated postmodernism. So all the philosophers on the show won't get mad at me, but that's actually, I really love this, right? It's literally, it's completely meaningless. It's whatever you bring to it. I love it.
Right. And so people are excited about it because it's completely meaningless and yet financially has proven to be extremely valuable, right? So I think the average auction price for a noun right now is around 65 ETH. The last I checked, ETH is selling at around $1,500 at the moment. So you could do the math on how much one of these things costs.
Yeah. And I think the treasury is like 25,000 or 30,000 ETH or something at this point, right?
Insane amount of money, right? So going back to the question around like mercenaries versus missionaries, you got some people who are like, oh yeah, I'm so excited about this mission. What are they excited about? I don't actually know because there is no mission except for proliferating the meme. But they say they're excited about the mission and they truly just want to see like the Nouns ecosystem succeed, right? And I'm being like a bit tongue-in-cheek here. Like obviously some people see Nouns as an opportunity to like bring tokenized communities to the mainstream and want Nouns to succeed so that this type of organization and this conversation around ownership that we're having is brought to more people. On the other hand though, you have people who are saying Nouns has a really big treasury. How can we put up proposals to get as much money out of this treasury as possible? And obviously, obviously they have to deliver on the proposal that they're making. But if you only do it once and you can convince enough Nouns to vote for you the first time, theoretically, you don't need to deliver, right? Theoretically, I could put up a proposal. I could ask for 100 ETH. I could say I'm going to make a Nouns movie and that Nouns movie will never exist and nobody can do anything about it. So obviously, again, worst case scenario there, we're hoping that like the social pressure of delivering actually leads people to deliver. And if you don't deliver once, then you're never going to be able to make your proposal again. But the open question here is around, as we're thinking about like new forms of ownership, you are going to have good actors and you are going to have bad actors. And inevitably, all of these actors are going to be a part of the ecosystem. My question for you is, both from your experience and just like speaking more theoretically, how you see that battle, I guess, playing out? And do you think the existence of bad actors and a lack of incentive structure and a lack of mechanism designed to disincentivize bad actors is going to lead to like these experiments with ownership actually like going backwards and people are going to be like, actually, never mind. Like, we don't want to go down this route. The traditional corporation was good enough for us.
Oh God, that would honestly be such a sad conclusion from this. Cause I think like, you know, I think you asked two questions, but I think, you know, the missionaries and mercenaries thing, I think the answer is that there, for me, is that there is always going to be that, right? Like, and one of the things I draw on for this is there's this great book I read, like when I used to have time to read books, it was about 2 years ago. It was the evolution of social complexity something about order in stateless societies, basically. And the whole point was, in the last 20 years, there have been some really interesting findings in anthropological game theory. Essentially, if you read a lot of, and I'll put some of this stuff in the show notes, but like there's a guy, Robert Axel, I think his name was, or Axel, Robert Axelrod, who wrote a book about 40 years ago called The Evolution of Cooperation. And he was able to mathematically show a very simple mathematical thing, which I think a lot of crypto people are aware of, but essentially some of the early findings in game theory were essentially the ones that everyone knows, right? Or stuff like prisoner's dilemma, where like, oh yeah, well, if you should always be defecting, obviously, mathematically, blah, blah. But that's I think one of the key insights lost to folks like that is if it's a finite game, right? That you know how many times it repeats. And so if you're in an infinite game, which is really what the context is for most people, cooperation wins for the most part. It depends on context, but that's like basically true. And so you have game theorists who've been working with anthropologists who have been looking at some of the findings in the last 25 years from archaeology and from anthropology around the world for, hey, why did people across Peru and the Fertile Crescent and, you know, uncontacted or pre-Columbian Native America all get together, build what seems like giant cities that could house 15 and 20,000 people seasonally, and then just fuck off, and also make weird, like gigantic monoliths of like millions of seashells in North America, right? Like, and you know, 30,000 years ago, and then just fuck off, or come back to them and fuck off, and don't really do anything with them, right? And my answer would be that those were the first nouns, right? Basically, and then to get like. Yeah. Seriously, right? Like, to prove me wrong, right? Like, of course there's ritual built around these, right? Like the name of the book is starting to come back to me, the full name. It was The Evolution of Social Complexity, Ritual and Social Complexity in Stateless Societies, right? And so essentially what they were talking about is the coordination of economic activity built around ritual in stateless societies pre-Westphalian nation state and all the sort of, you know, intersubjective realities of an LLC and all that kind of stuff, right? So a super common pattern seen across the entire world, almost entirely across the world, is, you know, you'd have like, you know, Europeans showed up and they'd be like, yo, this guy's the chief, right? He's essentially the king. And it's like, no, actually, he doesn't have any of the coercive powers that you associate with yours. If he starts telling people that they're going to go to jail, you're going to kill him, they laugh at his ass or they kill him. Right. But at the same time, he serves a very important ceremonial role. Like, if you look at the Maori, one example from the book was essentially that there's a special kind of communal hut that's super ornate that was built in the center of the town. And they would have the person, they switch this role pretty often, but the person would use these things to coordinate labor, right, seasonally. And then in some places, you would actually you'd waver in and out of hierarchies throughout the season. I'm giving this a long-winded answer to your point, right? But my point being that, like, you know, are there missionaries and mercenaries? This is going to be a problem for governance and stuff. I'm like, my answer is always has been, right? And then I'm going to answer you the meme, always has been. And I think that the corporation and various structures that kind of began to be ossified in the current sort of organizations we have defined a lot of those spaces that we used that were really murky around this kind of stuff, where it's like, hey, in spring we go here and we have, you know, this guy tells us what to do and coordinates all the labor. By the time fall comes around, you can fuck off to the woods, pick whatever you want. That guy's an asshole. No one cares what he says, right? And that kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore, right? Your boss is your boss, CEO, the governance rights trickle down the organization. Eventually, you don't even have any of them, right? And so I'd say, like, this is the cost we pay for saying that we want to participate more of them, right? And I think that nouns is a fascinating experiment on that front, where yes, someone can show up and do the classic thing of defecting and just saying, hey, this is fine. You basically already put it in similar terms. You just didn't use the same, you know, technical game theory terminology of like, an actor showed up and played a finite game and defected once. Well, we know that guy got 20 free ETH or whatever it was, but we'll never see him again, right? We already kind of have a way to handle that. Right.
Right.
Of course, there's a way to come in and take much more than that. And, you know, people have to figure out, well, what should we do with a noun style? But I think that's always been the case. And so I think that what I'm interested in seeing with this dynamic is, what do people come up with? Are there going to be new gradations of things that we automatically outsource and say that can always be done because we trust that the last three people who did it did it just fine. And we don't need to bring it up to governance. Are there going to be add-ons to the way that the Nouns uses its thing? Or is it just going to be collecting more and more ETH in its treasury forever and doing nothing with it? Any of the things I think are okay, right? It's more about what we learned from them. And I think that something like Nouns is one of the only things I've seen that's going to let us really see those things outside of a textbook currently, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that was a fascinating example. Definitely want to pick up that book.
I will get you the exact, I'll put it in the show notes, the exact author and the title, because I'm over here like, wow, I just don't
even know. Titles, like, I don't even know what to, but it's okay. But yeah, to your point, I mean, the question was definitely pessimistic. And I think I like 95% align with the perspective that you just outlined. I think like the one thing that continues to be a question mark for me is these games are only games if we have like players, right? And it seems like in some of these DAOs, all of these DAOs, Nouns included, there's a lot of NPCs, right? There's a lot of folks who are like holding on to the token and doing nothing, right? They just sit there. They do not participate in governance. They do not like give their opinion on things until they need to, right? Until they want to do so. And I always wonder like to what extent that is just natural, that is okay. Like we see like, if I don't feel like something is important enough to vote on and like the decisions are sort of just like going along with what I would expect them to go on, or like I'm neutral towards them, that's fine. But at the same time, these institutions could be like completely overthrown. That overthrown is a poor term, but like completely like turned about.
Hijacked.
There we go. If some people who aren't participating in governance suddenly decided to participate in governance one day. And I think you can go back to this point that you just made that like if you take it as an infinite game, the people who know that they have a lot of power in these organizations are incentivized not to use that power, or at least not to use it in a negative way, because then that power is no longer meaningful after they decide to delegitimize it. At the same time, though, like that always exists, right? That opportunity always exists. And it's question to what extent do we accept that things are valuable only to the extent that the folks who have power agree to keep it legitimate.
Oh yeah, that's a major, major problem too. Like, let me not downplay that, right? Like, I do think it always has been that way, and Nouns has to figure it out, because if the fact is that if someone can do it, they will, right? Like, it's only a matter of time. So the fact that it hasn't happened yet is like, oh, it's really great, but it's going to happen.
Right, right. And it's not just a Nouns problem, right? It's not just a Nouns problem at all. Like, imagine Gitcoin. Like, I don't want to get into like the inner mechanisms of Gitcoin governance, but Gitcoin's purpose is funding public goods. You could imagine some like Gitcoin whale coming in and saying, screw public goods. Like, we're going to allocate all of this money towards, I don't know, oil. Like, wouldn't that be ironic? But it's possible, right? And I think like we're, as much as we can get very, again, like kumbaya, like there's all these major question marks about how we deal with these edge cases. And to your point, like anything that can happen will happen, especially at scale.
Absolutely. And it
definitely conversations that we need to be having.
Yeah, for sure. And I would say like for myself, there's a lot, and I say this to DAO people all the time, right? There's like 100,000 lessons to learn from history on this one. And a lot of anarchist history has a lot of these learnings because we failed at it many, many times, right? And so that doesn't mean we don't keep trying, but like the whole thing is basically like, you know, to sound like a kind of a libertarian for a second, but like because I hate there isn't better language for this, but you know, the whole thing that we're trying to solve here is like, look, some of the, you know, hardcore neolibs or libertarians, you know, will tell you like, hey, capitalism equals markets and all that. And it's like, well, people without modern, you know, global markets, without money, without police, without bureaucracies, without social classes and other coercive mechanisms, develop norms and rules of economic and social cooperation that were sustainable over thousands of years. How do they do it? Right. And like one of the major answers we already covered, right, was like by ritualizing the economy. Right. That's right. Basically what they did. And like, I would argue that whether they know it or not, people who are doing this stuff are already ritualizing the economy within DAOs. These are their own rituals. Right. And I think we need to foreground some of the subtext in a lot of that stuff and say like, hey, did you guys know that by assigning a directly responsible individual for that decision, we've just done the directly responsible individual ritual? What do we want out of it? when you were at your corporation, they just told you it was that guy. And it was that guy because he proved he could do it at three other places and he has more stock than you. That's the only reason why. Is that the only reason it should be that way? I don't know. We're just printing nouns, baby. But maybe we should do something about that and decide how we use the ether that comes out of it, right? And it turns out that we can have a new ritual, right? It can be a new institution. And we can decide, you know, how we can develop these norms of cooperation or nothing. But I think that if we do nothing, like you said, we have many agents with many different types of desires and preferences, and some ones who can't, you know, help themselves or don't want or just want to enrich themselves will do it. So we must design something that addresses that or we're fucked.
Yeah. No, exactly. And to your point, like when you see it through the lens of rituals, like when you bring this metaphor up, then it's like, okay, what is today's ritual, right? Like, and the ritual of we assign that guy, like that guy's in charge. Like that is a ritual at the end of the day.
That's only the ritual.
Right. So yeah, all of these, I hate this term, but it's always the term that like just comes to mind, but all of these mental models from history are.
I hate this term too. It's way overused, but I'll allow it.
But it works. It works. But they definitely, I'll plug, there was like a, I was working with other internets and Orca Protocol, now called Metropolis, on a event called the Governance Learning Forum. And yeah. It was basically this, right? It was crypto people, DAO people have no idea what they're talking about. They only read books that are like, and essays that are like 3 years old. There are professors across the world whose entire job is to study like, not just like corporate governance, but like the history of like democracy and the history of like societal participation and like all these like really big ideas that are directly applicable to what we're doing and people are just ignoring, right? So we ran an event and we basically said, we're going to get all these crypto people in a room and we're going to get a professor and the professor is going to talk about these things, not in crypto terms. You're just going to get a lesson.
I love it.
It was the best crypto related events that I have been to thus far.
It reminds me of something actually. So there's a book I read, let's see, last year in February, I believe, when I read this book. It's called Rational Ritual. And basically the guy's main point in this book was essentially that to understand how people solve coordination problems, you have to look at social processes that generate common knowledge and knowledge of others' knowledge. Of a common message at multiple levels of organization. And he said basically that the best example we have currently are public rituals like ceremonies, rallies, media events. And then this was like, I believe this was early 2000s. So it was before the type of internet we have today, the type of internet we have and the internet culture we have existed. And so, you know, he could just point to stuff like, you know, like TV shows, what he called common knowledge generators and common knowledge space. And this whole point in it was basically that we require common knowledge so that we know where we stand and what we want to do, right? And so social institutions help fulfill this need for common knowledge. And so when you ask a person, hey, why does the DMV exist? Right? And people are like, well, it's to make sure there aren't any bad drivers. And make sure that everyone falls, has gone through the same thing that ensures they know how to drive and all of that. And I'd be like, wrong answer. Like, it's to make us all feel that way. If you actually spend a day inside of it, you realize how full of shit that is. Right. And so, like, the institution itself is and there's another great paper on this that I'll put in the show notes, but basically it's about institutions as myth, basically. And so, like, and how they perpetuate that myth and have zero incentive to ever question the myth, because the second they do, they lose legitimacy, right. And so you wrap these institutions up in myth and ritual, you call them rational and bureaucratic, and voila, we have an explanation for many of the institutional failures that exist, and a lot of the reason why DAOs even need to kind of innovate and think about these things in new ways, right? I always say they have a chance at a full-throated, authentic case for some, like, actually have inhabiting these institutions that exist today that only purport to do so, right? And so that's really, for me, the promise of DAOs is that you might be able to, you know, when you consider all the ownership stuff we talked about and all that, you know, someone comes in and says, hey, you know, I'm going to use the that guy example again. That guy, he's the guy. That's the guy that tells us what to do, right? Whenever you get started a new job as an IC or an individual contributor, who's my boss? My boss is that guy. All right. So that's the person, this woman, that dude, whatever, I got to figure, he's going to tell me what to do. Figure out my teammates, right? At the end of the day, though, jihad, if you have an idea that goes against your boss's incentives, makes them look bad, or actually makes them like, that's their, you know, you might be thinking, oh, he's, I don't really get concretely what this guy's talking about, common knowledge and like this. And I'm like, no, that's a really perfect example. The social capital your boss has matters. You must think through that filter and say, how is what I'm going to do going to make them look? And you may think, oh, well, I don't want to work in a kind of place like that. And I'm like, well, eventually you will. Good luck. Right? But that's kind of the point, is like, can we get in a place where you as an individual go, we need to go this way. And you, when going back to the thing you were talking about all the way at the beginning of the pod around tokenized community, saying, how can I govern the funds that we have and direct them at a cause that I think we need to use it for and do it together, right? That's not a thing that is easily done today in a currently existing institution. And so that's kind of like maybe to wrap up that thread and get us on a path to closing out today's pod. That's truly the whole promise for me, and maybe partly for you as well, on tokenized communities. What do you think?
No, I mean, I agree across the board. I think going back to what we were saying before about like the social versus the technical, like the promise for me from a practical perspective, like if I were to go pitch a VC right now, I think there are practical purposes of like, oh, like we're helping fund creators and we're turning more people into entrepreneurs to give them autonomy over their work. I believe all of those things. I think all of those things are true. But at the end of the day, those things are true because we are challenging the myth of the corporation and traditional organization as it stands today. And the more that we can spark conversation around that, the more that we can get people questioning these things, the more that we can get people talking about them, we will realize that 98% of people have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. But those 2% are going to be very, very interesting to listen to and begin to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, just to add on that, you had said this earlier and I just went over my head, and I always have to bring this up. You were talking about how essentially you could describe the free rider problem, right? You're going to have people in a DAO who just, they aren't going to want to do shit ever. And then, you know, some people will. And then one day, if some of those people decide, actually, I am going to do shit, I'm going to be a bad actor, I'm going to defect, then that's a problem, right? But like, I think at the end of the day, a lot of our current institutions basically just say, how can we make sure that if a bad actor does a thing, they can get punished for it always? And punishment is like the only real thing, the only tool in the box, right? But like the real thing that we should be thinking about is like, well, we bucket a whole bunch of things in the punishment box and say, you can't do that, right? And then if we open that up, we realize maybe some of that isn't punishment, and that at the end of the day, it takes, this is going to be, I don't think I'm going to live to see this. I don't think you are, maybe you will, I don't know. But this might happen on too long of a time scale. But essentially, with what you're doing in tokenized communities, we are just demanding people to take responsibility for things, essentially, at the end of the day. We're saying, hey, you're here. You own a piece of this. Give a shit about it. Start caring, right? Or you could just go back there and do the paycheck thing and not care. No one needs you here. But that's really what it's all about, right? Because I think a lot of the major problems in institutions that we've been talking a lot about them is that people just kind of outsource their caring to them, right? They're like, hey, you know, man, this neighborhood's really falling apart. We should get cops to handle, do something about this, right? Like, hey, name a thing. We just go, hey, it's not my problem. We got an institution. We got a bureaucracy over there, right? So I think that's the main thing to come back to see.
Yeah.
How can we get as many people to give a shit about this and realize that they have to?
That, I guess this is a good way to end things, but like such a tough question to think about, because on one hand you have like the hope of, wow, all of this innovation that is happening, we're doing a lot of thinking, people are asking questions, this is so exciting. And then you rewind and you're like, but are people actually going to give a shit? And that is the question that we need to go to sleep and wake up with every morning and try to fight towards. It's like, can we actually get people to care about this thing? And going back to the very, very beginning of the pod, it's like, how do we remove the jargon away from the conversation, which I don't think I did a very good job of on this combo, but like general, to get people to care? And how do we continue to reframe these ideas to get people to care? And it just, you got to do it over and over and over and over and over again, even to just get one person to care. So yeah, it's exciting. That is why we need to continue to discuss the ownership economy.
Absolutely, because I think like it's a long game. And some would say, I would say at least, that it has always been about that. It sounds kind of cheesy, but it's always been about getting more people to care at the end of the day. Because part of the reason why a lot of institutions are failing is that they're just like, it's not my problem. Right. But now, if we can, the whole thesis behind it is if we can get more people to have upside in it, maybe they will care.
Right.
At least partly for me. Well, Jihad, one last thing before we tune out here after this lovely conversation is we always give people an opportunity to shill. So please shill. Tell us where to find you on the internet. Tell us about your projects. Tell us how to follow up.
Oh, heck yeah. That's my favorite thing to do. I'm on Twitter at J.A. Esmail. So J.A. and then my last name. You could find tweets about DAOs, about Forefront, about Drake, and a few other things in between. And check out Forefront if you're interested in this whole idea of like tokenized communities, how tokenized communities can impact creators, how we can build new social networks and new opportunities for folks to build outside of traditional funding mechanisms. Come to Forefront. Forefront.market is the domain. Forefront.news if you want to check out our newsletter. And yeah, just would love to see some new faces in the community and new folks checking out our work.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, man. This has been fun and wide-ranging. Just the kind of summer chop-it-up conversation we're looking to have on the pod, man.
Good stuff. Appreciate you for having me. This is great.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, man.